It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. It's amazing that we're all here in New York with all the crazy weather that we've been having and snow and sleet and black ice. But we're here because we want to be here and we have a lot of great things to talk about. Now, you know, this is a live call-in show, so if at any time you have a comment or question, you can call in at 1-888-874-4888. And I'm always happy to take your comments and questions. You can send me an email now during the show. No, not now during the show. I'm not set up for that, but anytime during the week at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Okay, my very interesting guest with me today is Rin Berry, and we had him on the show over a year ago, and he specializes in the study of vegetarianism from a historical perspective. He's the author of 6 books on vegetarianism, The New Vegetarians, Famous Vegetarians, Foods, Food for the Gods, Vegetarianism and the World's Religions, Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover, and The Vegan Guide to New York City. His 6th book, Becoming Raw, which has co-authored with vegan nutritionists Vincenzo Molina and Brenda Davis, came out in September 2009. He has many articles, as well as reviews of his books, which have appeared in Ahimsa, The American Vegan, Vegetarian Voice, Vegetarian Journal, Satya Yoga Journal, and newspapers such as The New York Times, The Toronto Star, The New York Daily News, The Los Angeles Times, The Times of London, The London Sunday Telegraph, and The Washington Post. Welcome, Rin Berry.
Pleasure to be here, Karen.
Now, there's something missing from what I read, because I know that you've done some writing for encyclopedias.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention that. I was commissioned to write definitive article on the history of vegetarianism in the U.S., for the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink.
Hmm.
And subsequently, that was so well received that they decided to do an Oxford companion to American Food and Drink, which appeared 2 years later, and I was commissioned to do 7 articles on various aspects of vegan and vegetarian diet.
Excellent. Well, I think you might be seeing more of these, because certainly vegetarianism and veganism is becoming so mainstream. Mm-hmm. As many people know, Oprah just had the Vegan Challenge on her show this week, and her entire Harpo staff, some 378 people, mm-hmm. Attempted a vegan diet for a week. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting program that she had on about it. It's just amusing to some of us who have been doing it for so long. It's not a challenge. It's easy. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
And now, for me, it's been, 30-plus years. I don't know about for you, Rin. Mm-hmm. But there are so many products in the stores today that it's so easy.
Yeah.
And on the Internet, so many wonderful free recipes. It's easy, it's delicious, it's good for the planet. I want to talk about vegetarian history, but before I do, I want to imagine maybe 50 years or so into the future, or even 100 years into the future. What do you think historians will be saying about us today? Tricky question.
Yeah. I think, this is a watershed period when people in the West are starting to embrace a vegetarian diet in greater and greater numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the beginning of this millennium, the third millennium, is the time when what I think it will be is historically significant for the conversion of Westerners to a plant-based diet.
You know, I would like to think at some point the vegetarian diet will be the most popular diet, if not the only diet. And, you know, some say that will never happen, and I don't think I will ever know what the future holds in 100 years or so. But there have been some articles that have talked about how if we do become a vegetarian, vegan society, and we need to because the earth cannot sustain us growing animals to feed people. It's not efficient. There's not enough land mass, even in these horrific confined factory farms. Okay, so let's say that we do. It's amusing to think about imagining historians talking about us as barbaric.
Yes.
Eating animals.
Yeah.
Like, what an incredible thought.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I agree. I think it is the mark of the barbarians, and certainly in antiquity, the civilized peoples of the world were vegans, vegetarians, and it was the barbaric peoples, the nomadic peoples of the steppe lands and northern Europe, the Huns, the Germans, the Scythians. These were the meat eaters, and they were very bellicose and warlike people who were constantly invading the southern lands, the fruitful lands of the south, India, southern Europe, and the rest. And it's reflected in their religious orientation. They had male warrior gods. And the southern peoples, the vegan peoples of the southern Europe and Southwest Asia, were all had mother goddesses. And
do you equate meat eating with violence and war?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And vegetarianism with peace?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Although, if called upon, vegetarians can be
can be very brutal.
Can be quite.
I know a few.
Yeah. obviously, there are many vegetarians in the Indian Army, so, and they're capable of defending themselves.
Right. Well, sure. We know many, many physically fit and muscular athletes that are vegan, so just because you're a vegan doesn't mean that you're not strong.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a fallacy that has been refuted by the examples of our current athletic champions. You know, most of the title holders in the endurance sports are now vegans.
Or realizing the importance of plant foods versus animal foods.
Absolutely. You know, Carl Lewis is a classic example of a modern athlete who has shattered all the records and holds the record for gold medals won in the Olympic field competitions.
Right.
So, but then today, and all the the top triathletes and Ironman triathlons champions compete as vegans. Dave Scott, I think, holds the record for over 5 Ironmans, and he competed as a vegan. It's just all the records are falling to the new vegan crop of vegan athletes. Brendan Brazier is the most recent, I guess.
Yeah.
He wrote that book called The Thrive Diet.
Well, he has an interesting perspective on it after reading his book, where he realized the advantage you get from eating plant foods for an athlete is that the recovery period between workouts is shortened.
Yeah.
Which enables the vegan athlete to train more and become better, faster. I like that.
And he's not only is he a vegan, but he's a raw foodist.
Right. So and he's a very nice man.
Yes. That's important. Vegans have better manners.
Well, I don't want to go there because I know examples of good people and bad people.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think overall there is... Although I don't know if there's been any studies, although there have been little suggestions about students in school where they're fed, when they're fed healthier whole foods, plant foods primarily, and less junk foods, their behavior improves and their learning improves, and there have been studies that show that both ways. Children that are vegetarian have higher IQs, and children with higher IQs tend to want to be vegetarian more often.
Absolutely.
So, I think just like Will Tuttle had put it in his book, The World Peace Diet, there are definitely lots of compelling arguments that the vegan diet is definitely a path towards peace.
Oh, certainly, And I agree with you that people's behavior can be modified in the direction of serenity and gentleness.
So in history...
Not only people, but animals, too. I mean, I have friends who've actually turned their cats, you know, their felines, vegan.
Into vegan. Now, that's an interesting one. I know plenty of dogs, but I know the cats are particularly more difficult to do that.
Yeah, it's not easy. In fact, one has to... prepare for the owner of the restaurant, the Peace Food Cafe, Eric. Do you know Eric?
Yeah.
He told me that he rescued two cats.
And they're vegan?
And he turned them vegan.
Oh, that's amazing.
Of course, he has the resources.
He's a great chef.
He's a great chef.
He can find the recipe.
He serves them leftovers from the cafe at night. He takes them home. And they've stopped. He said that they'd stopped chasing mice.
Oh, this is
after they've been vegan for...
I'm going to have to interview him on that one.
Yeah.
Because I guess I'm not a cat. I'm not an owner or a guardian, excuse me for the wrong word, of animals. And those that I know that have cats, especially cats that they've rescued, it's really hard to change their behavior.
Yeah, that's true.
That it might be easier with newborn kittens to get them on a plant-based diet.
Yeah,
but they also
yeah.
require certain supplements.
That's right, I think.
Taurine.
Yeah, taurine.
Okay.
And I know the cats at Farm Sanctuary are also vegan, and allow them to
roam.
Forage outside.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point, but I do prefer to focus on the really big things that are so awful. So... Sure, we can talk about cats and dogs, and it's interesting. And who knows where we'll ultimately go? I would like to think that the lion will lie down with the lamb at some point. but right now, my mission is to focus on factory farming and make it illegal and get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a proponent of grass-fed animals for food, but it's so much better than cramming animals in factories. But what people don't realize, and I say over and over again, if you want to eat grass-fed beef and grass-fed pasture-raised animals, you still have to eat a lot less because the earth cannot grow the quantity of animals that we're growing today if we don't confine them. It's quite simple. So it's about more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. That's my mantra. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, raw nuts, and seeds.
Right, right.
Okay. So, Rin Berry, who's here with me today, is the author of The Vegan Guide to New York City, which he just pointed out to me is now in its 17th edition. So this is the
18th year.
18th year.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And every year it gets a little thicker.
That's
it's
right.
a small book, but it gets more and more. It says there's over 100 restaurants in here. Well,
actually, we just counted them the other day for the app. You know, it's now an iPhone app as well as.
Oh, great!
And we actually came up with 122 vegan and vegetarian, and they're exclusively plant-based. I mean, they don't have any. They don't serve any. Not even a sliver of fish. Otherwise, they're beyond the pale.
The scaly vegetable.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
Well, this is really exciting because, New York City is the greenest city in the world, and we do have more vegan and vegetarian restaurants here than anywhere else.
Yeah, it's surprising.
but, okay, I definitely hope that, well, it is. It's definitely spanning out worldwide, but we have so many choices here, and there was a time when I thought I knew them all, and I don't anymore. There's just so many that keep popping up. So I just heard today.
That's why I put it out every year because it's such a dynamic market that there are new ones.
I just heard there was a vegan bar in Brooklyn.
Yeah, Lucky 13, probably.
Lucky 13, is that in here?
Actually, no.
Because it's new.
Yeah, no, it's been around for a few years.
Oh,
well,
okay.
The owners of Lucky 13 they own the food swings. They acquired Food Swings.
Okay.
About 3 years ago, they purchased it from the founder, founding chef. And they've done a terrific job with it. You know, I don't know if you've ever...
I was in Food Swings when it first opened early on, and I thought it was a great thing that they were doing, but there was nothing there that I would eat.
It's really...
It was vegan junk food. Yeah. It was... Everything was fried.
It's, yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to eat that kind of food, why not eat it from plants? Why do you have to torture animals if you're going to have that stuff? But they had, like, a Philly cheesesteak sandwich.
Yeah, the vegan equivalent, yeah.
And all these
fries. And they have the corn dogs. And,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, when food is prepared like that, where it's processed and fried and, and got all kinds of seasonings, you can't tell if it's
from
an animal or not.
Yeah, sure.
That's the crazy part about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although people have a delicate palate can
maybe.
Smell the...
It smells better.
Yeah.
Okay, so where can we find this book? It's in Whole Foods.
Yeah, it's in the Whole Foods. Not all the Whole Foods sell books now. They've cut back on their book.
Okay.
Book
I'm
offerings.
Sorry about that for you.
Yeah, no, but two of them do. And so the Whole Foods Chelsea and Whole Foods Bowery. It's a big seller.
Okay. Well, this is a really convenient thing to have because there are... It's light and easy to carry around, and when you're roaming around New York City as a tourist or as a resident, there are so many wonderful things to try. I'm just going to roll through here because there are so many different ones. I just want to highlight the diversity in vegan cuisine.
Yeah.
So we start out in the beginning in Harlem because it's north of Central Park.
Yes.
And let's see, I have not been to Cafe Veg, which is West Indian.
Yeah, it's really very tasty. I like their they call it Italian food, or it's I guess it was invented in the Caribbean among those the followers of Haile Selassie. You know the.
Oh, I don't.
They have kind of a little religion.
And that's vegetarian?
And it's vegetarian, yeah. The members are obliged to be vegetarian.
Excellent. And then I've been to Raw Soul, really creative raw food restaurant up there.
Mm-hmm.
Strictly Roots, is that the one where they have all the hot dishes and you can pick?
Yeah.
Yeah, really fun foods there. And the Uptown Juice Bar. Okay,
yeah, in fact,
very good.
The owner of the Uptown Juice Bar owns Cafe Veg. So.
Oh, okay, branching out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Upper West Side. I just want to stroll through here because I want to just see all the ones that I've been to and all the ones I haven't been to while I'm here looking through this book. The Ayurveda Cafe has been around a while, and they have dairy and vegan options.
Yeah, it's lacto-vegetarian. Yeah.
But you can get vegan there.
Sure.
And then Blossom Uptown Cafe is near here and is just phenomenal.
Terrific.
And they're exploding.
Yeah, and Pamela is the owner. But she's very entrepreneurial.
Blossom Du Jour Cafe, Blossom Restaurant, and Coco V.
Coco V,
which is
Chocoholics delight, right? They specialize in chocolates.
Right. And then you can go to Cafe Viva for pizza.
Yeah. But it's not
not vegan.
It's not a thoroughgoing vegan pizza parlor. I'd love to see one.
That was vegan,
alike in New York. Maybe, there's one just opened in Boston. So we may get one soon because Boston also had the first vegan ice cream shop.
Which one is that?
It was called Wheeler's.
It wasn't a brand, but it was just a shop.
No, it was opened by a black man, and he was the first to do it, I think, to pioneer a vegan ice cream parlor, I think. And now there are two in New York, so it seems that Boston seems to be a trendsetter in that regard.
Right, and it's definitely a fun thing to be able to go and get ice cream. Why not? In a cone.
I'm sure you've been
to Lulu's.
Lulu's, that's the favorite.
Mm-hmm. And she is lovely.
Yeah, Blythe and her husband, her partner, Derek. He's from Ireland, and he has a decided brogue. And he's a cabinet maker, and he built the whole interior.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
From scratch,
I like the brick wall.
And it looks just like one of those 40s, 1940s or 50s.
Ice cream.
Yeah,
places.
Traditional
yeah.
ice cream shop with double P-E, you know.
Right, shoppy.
Yeah.
And then there are more fast food places popping up. And again, this is not my kind of food because I'm into more raw, more healthy, less processed.
Sure,
but, you know, we live in a processed world.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's going to be processed, it might as well be plant-based. And some of them are healthier than others. So there's these falafel places like Ma'o's that's popping up.
Right.
There's a bunch of them now in New York.
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah, there's...
And that's falafel and a salad bar. And
I guess the latest is a place called Shroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's in this neighborhood, actually.
I haven't been there.
And,
what have they got?
It's another Israeli falafel shack, is like.
Okay.
And it's lacto. Again, it's lacto vegetarian. But.
Okay, I haven't collected any numbers, but there seem to be more hummus and falafel places popping up everywhere.
Yes.
I'm not just talking about vegetarian. There's just like an influx.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas of why that is or why that's happening? And I love that food. And I love it because there are more plant options in these places,
absolutely.
Even when they're serving meat.
Well, most of the owners are Israeli, and it's Near Eastern, you know, Middle Eastern food.
Mm-hmm.
It's not peculiar to Israel. I mean, you can find it in any Arab
right.
country. But they seem to be more in the forefront of opening these places.
Yeah, it's great. It's really great. More plant foods.
And the joke is that, you know, you don't have to go to Tel Aviv to have a meal because you can go to
well, I'll tell you the best
local falafel shack.
I've been to Israel several times, and I worked for an Israeli company, so I've had a lot of falafel and a lot of hummus and a lot of their other dishes.
Yeah.
But I think the best Middle Eastern food I ever had was in Evanston, Illinois.
No kidding. Wow. How did that come about?
I don't know why it was so good, but it was. I ate there a lot. Okay. Soy and sake. I haven't been there, and it looks really lovely. They have a lot of those meat analogs there.
Yeah, it's really, the food is extraordinary there. And it's the first vegan sushi bar in the U.S., or in the world, as far as I know.
Vegan sushi bar.
But I didn't give it a thumbs up.
Okay.
For the reason that they have an aquarium.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they weren't thinking everything through there.
Yeah.
Okay,
so you see all these...
For those who aren't following what we're saying, usually in an aquarium, there are live fish.
Mm.
And they are imprisoned, actually, when they're in an aquarium. Some may not realize that. I mean, just imagine you living in a big box filled with water or not.
Yeah. Right,
so for a group to be making meals specifically that don't have fish, you would think that they would get it. Okay, oops.
So, I would have given them a rave review and thumbs up, but they spoiled it with by having an aquarium fish tank.
Okay, well, we do the best we can.
Yeah.
What I love is...
So that just shows that, by way of showing there's sort of an ethical component to the vegan guide. You know, I don't just rate them on the food alone, but, you know, do they have fish, captive animals in the restaurant, you know, like fish or birds, you know, that can certainly...
Well, that's the thing. The vegan diet, when compared to a vegetarian diet, the vegan diet is really not just a diet. It's a lifestyle,
right.
And it incorporates more than just food, and we talk about that all the time on this show.
Right.
Okay.
So if they're displaying, feathers or leather in the interior, that also counts against them.
Okay, there are restaurants in here I've never seen before. So Raw Star... raw West Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
Now, that's like, I want to say an oxymoron almost, because most Indian food is cooked and way overcooked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's West Indian, in other words, Caribbean.
Okay, so like the stuff the other restaurants
have.
Yeah,
the Ital. But it's more, it's raw, a raw interpretation of Ital food. And the fellow who owns it His name is Moby, and he's a disciple of Aris Latham, the legendary raw food, gourmet raw food chef who used to have a place in Brooklyn.
Mm.
And is now, I guess he's now in Brazil, actually.
So, and then there's Rockin' Raw. Is that another raw restaurant?
Yeah, that's right. That's,
so how many raw restaurants do we have in New York?
I think about 12.
Wow.
I count. And there isn't, I count the little raw food bar at Westerly. I'm sure you're familiar
mm-hmm.
with that one, right?
Right.
That counts as kind of a... Because you can actually have a meal there.
Absolutely. They have the raw lasagnas and the raw desserts.
Right. Some delicious raw entrees. And you can always supplement it with the raw snacks that they sell in that little nook in the back of the store.
This is really incredible. And in addition, in this book, there's advertisements by people that have products like Parma, vegan Parmesan.
Right, yeah, there.
And, oh my God, I've never seen this. Soy gelato. Soy gelato by mail. We ship anywhere in the USA. Blackwell's organic soy gelato and fruit sorbetto at Whole Foods. And you can get it by mail. Gelatobymail.com. Now that sounds interesting.
Yeah. And we even have a raw food restaurant that is in cyberspace, actually, in the back. You can order... By FedEx, they ship it by FedEx, so you can order anywhere in the country, and they'll ship you a vegan meal.
Who is that?
It's called Veggie Brothers.
Oh, I've heard about them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a page devoted to them. You want me to show you?
No, I want to find it. No, you find it.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, you also list juice bars while you're looking for that page.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to say about that, which really amazes me, is there are many, many juice bars in New York City, and I'm grateful for that because I juice every day, and if I don't do it at home, I have to get it out there. Okay, cyberspaceveggiebrothers.com. Check that out. Shipped frozen to your door. They have... I've been to their website, veggiebrothers.com, and it's amazing the choices that they offer. So here's an option. I wonder how long it takes. I mean, certainly it's not going to get to your door that night when you want it.
No.
You have to plan, but there's a
ahead.
Lot of options. But back to the juice bars. There are many juice bars, and you list some of them in your book.
My favorite is Liquiteria, Doug Green's Liquiteria.
And they've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
What amazes me is when I think of California...
I think
the image in general is that they're healthier and they eat healthy food and that they're all vegetarian and that they juice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not true. It's so hard to find a juice bar in California.
Mm-hmm.
They just aren't out there, and yet you can find them all over New York City.
Yeah. The same is true of restaurants, vegan restaurants. There aren't so many as one might think.
Right. They might have an option on the menu, but there aren't as many that are exclusive.
Yeah, exactly.
And personally, I prefer going to the exclusive ones because you know their kitchens aren't clean. And you know that, a little bit isn't going to get into your dish.
Yeah, there's no cross-contamination, no migration of food particles.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about this raw food diet, and you're one of the co-authors on Becoming Raw.
Yeah.
And I've talked about this a few times on the show, and it's a big book, and it's worth bringing up many times because it's filled with all kinds of great information.
Yeah, they're North America's leading nutritionists, Visanto Molina and Brenda Davis, and they hail from British Columbia.
Right, and so they're leading nutritionists in the United States, in addition
in
to
North
Canada
America.
Or North America.
America. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're both great.
Yeah.
So what did you contribute in
Mike contributed the history of the raw food movement, which is quite venerable.
Yeah. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, it goes back to Sylvester Graham, actually. He's credited by Herbert Shelton and other the natural hygienists with being the first hygienist or the first proponent of a raw food lifestyle.
Now, as I remember, graham crackers were sort of indirectly named after him.
Named
because
for him,
he was promoting whole wheat and whole grains. But he was on a primarily raw diet?
He himself did not practice it. I mean, he was a vegetarian, but he recommended it as the ideal diet, what he called the Edenic diet.
Yeah.
Diet of the, you know, the primal couple, Adam and Eve.
them.
those guys. And so he was recommending that that America embrace the original diet that was followed, that God had decreed that humans follow.
And this was about what time? What, 18 something?
He flourished in the 1830s and 40s.
Right. So this is a time when there was no internet.
No.
And no television.
Yeah, right.
And so how did this information get around?
Well, he was he lectured widely, and he was a great stump of orators, and he traveled the country, and he came to fame during the cholera, right after the cholera epidemic in the 1830s, and he urged people to eat lots of fruit and vegetables as a prophylaxis against cholera. You know, this is contrary to the received wisdom of the time. Doctors were urging people to avoid fruit because it harbored the deadly bacillus.
Mm-hmm.
So people who followed his diet actually came through it unscathed.
Wow.
So that's how he made his reputation, and then he was in demand as a speaker, and his books were bestsellers.
Now I imagine that he did receive some negative feedback from stuff he was putting out.
Oh yeah, I mean he was.
What was the medical community like back then?
They were very resistant to his preachings. Of course, he was urging people.
What has changed?
Very little.
Actually, what has changed since that time? It's becoming a little more. People are more aware of it and are more accepting of it.
Well, as you just mentioned, the internet and mass communications has made it easier to disseminate the information. So it's no longer the province of a few. You know, it's being widely. I mean, we have best-selling books on the topic. I was in Barnes & Noble the other day and Borders, and noticed they have whole sections devoted to vegan.
Right.
Cookbooks. And even raw food books.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, you have to give credit to the women who wrote, if you pardon the expression, skinny bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were certainly in the vanguard of making it popular and putting it.
You think that was one book that really.
That was a very seminal book. I mean, and also Alicia Silverstone's book.
Mm-hmm. Is that doing well?
I think it's a bestseller.
I think
Skinny Bitch book was really pivotal.
Right.
Because, I don't know, a lot of women read it, and women, of course, still shape our dietary preferences in the kitchen. And
you know, I haven't read the book.
Yeah. You know, and the thing about it is that it has a very graphic account of animal slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that ordinarily that would be anathema to a cookbook. You know, no one wants to read about intensive animal rearing and animal slaughter. But they're very candid. They have it right in their opening sections, and so I think that's had a huge impact.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we need to hear things over and over and over and over. Before we're willing to really let it sink in, I think. And so we need more books.
Yeah.
Saying the same thing, maybe packaged in a slightly different way.
And they've done it. They have five variations or more on the Skinny Bitch theme.
Mm-hmm.
They have Skinny Bitch in the Kitch.
Right.
Skinny, what is it? Skinny Bastard.
Right, for guys.
The male counterpart. And they have Skinny Bitch Bun in the Oven or something, you know.
Well, you know, I'm open to all of it. Whatever it takes to appeal to the different communities.
Yeah, yeah.
We certainly have different religious angles, the Christian Vegetarian Society.
Absolutely.
And the Jewish angle with mm-hmm. Richard Schwartz yeah. and the Jewish vegetarians.
Yes.
What about the Muslims? I've been looking. Are there books out on vegetarianism or?
They seem to be a little behind hand in the matter of vegetarianism. You know, the Sufis are a vegetarian sect. The esoteric sect of Islam is vegetarian. There are many, but among the Muslims as a in mass, you know, there's very little vegetarianism, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But that's not atypical of the Abrahamic religions. They all tend to be somewhat carnivorous, unfortunately.
Right. Looking back in history, how did that happen? I know you have a book out on
Food for the Gods,
the religions.
Yeah, religious.
Because most of them, as I remember, did have a vegetarian foundation.
Yeah. Originally, of course, among the Abrahamic religions, of course, Judaism had its Essene beginnings, and you know, it's purported that Jesus was an Essene, and he was a member of an anti-sacral sect that was trying to abolish animal sacrifice from the from the temple, and they were trying to recover a vegan Torah, because it was their belief that the Jews originally were vegans.
Wow.
And that the Torah had been corrupted by the animal sacrificing cult, the Aaronites and the Levites. So it does have, the Abrahamic religions do have this pristine vegan saga, and of course traces of this can be found in Genesis, of course.
Yes.
Adam and Eve, the Edenic diet, the Edenic couple.
It tells you right there in Genesis, 1:29?
Yeah.
That we should be eating plant foods, and it's just right there. It tells it like it is. And I've had numerous conversations with different people that believe in the Jewish faith, and some of them believe that they're instructed to eat meat.
Yeah. But that's, they believe it, of course, because
it just doesn't make sense when you put it all together. I'm not a religious person, so maybe I shouldn't be the one to speak, but when you have in one of your top 10 laws, thou shalt not kill,
yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, in the Hindu-based religions of Asia, like Hinduism and Jainism, the injunction against killing applies to all beings. And it's the first commandment in Jainism or Buddhism is a Hindu.
Respect all life.
Respect all life.
Now, I don't speak those languages, but did they say it in the affirmative that way, respect all life versus do not kill?
There's non-harming. Ahimsa means non-harming to all living creatures. Mm-hmm. So, I think we in the West would do well to emulate that position, that moral position. You know, that one should, that all life is sacred, and that Ahimsa trumps all the other commandments. Unfortunately, we don't have that in the Abrahamic. You know, the thou shalt not kill really doesn't extend to all living creatures.
Well, we don't know that. That's the thing. I mean, when I say thou shalt not kill, okay, I get it. Don't kill. That means don't kill. Does that mean don't kill all white men? Does it mean, you know, just Jewish men and women? Does it mean adults and not children?
Yeah.
Does it mean, it doesn't say, it just says thou shalt not kill. To me, that means period.
Sure,
no,
well, I agree. I think that, you know, it should be the first commandment, and as in the Hindu-based cultures, it should trump the others.
Mm-hmm.
And, but unfortunately, it's been, it's number six, not number one. And as it's been interpreted, it applies only to members of one's tribe and not to all living creatures, as it does in the Hindu-based. But, of course, you know, the Ebionites, the Essene sects, would have argued that it should be the first commandment. And in Matthew, Jesus actually does make non-killing the first precept of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, back to this becoming Rob and the history that you've contributed to. So did you start basically with the history in North America?
Yeah, North America. Of course, there's a deeper history. I mean, there's
sure. I mean, if we go back some 10,000 years or
to
whatever,
Aboriginal people of, of the Americas were not all carnivores, and not all eaters of cooked food.
Mm-hmm. Are there any communities today that eat primarily raw and not cooked food?
In North America, I don't think among not
or
among
around
the indigenous.
The world,
perhaps among some indigenous tribes in South America.
Some things that people don't think about. Okay, I eat raw and cooked food. There, I did 2 years completely raw, and I enjoyed it, and I have no problem with it. There are some places in Africa, other places, poor communities where the woman in particular who's preparing the food in their small hut or home have all kinds of health issues related to cooking food because the fumes are maintained inside and there's just a lot of pollution involved.
Absolutely, and carbon monoxide.
And it's something really serious, and if they only realized that they didn't have to cook their food, it would be a lot simpler.
Well, it's, you know, cooking food has always been regarded as conferring status on food, you know.
Conferring status on
you
food.
You know, high status. Higher status. And also, animal flesh, of course, has traditionally been a high status food. And I think that's changing now among cultural elites. Meat is now being frowned upon as a food. It's losing its caste, so to speak.
Okay, so let's go past Graham, and then what happened?
Well, after Graham, of course, there were these sort of some bona fide American eccentrics like Bronson Alcott, you know, who started a raw food community in Massachusetts, Fruitlands. It was the first.
He was related to Louisa.
Yeah, exactly.
Alcott,
her father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was she vegetarian?
She was a vegetarian perforce. I mean, she had to be because she was raised.
Right.
She had no choice. But as soon as she became an adult, she rebelled and. Oh. And started eating meat.
Oh, oops.
Yeah, which is why she didn't have such a very long life, I think. You know, her father outlived her.
Oh, wow. She's the author of Little Women.
Among others, yeah.
I remember reading that.
Yeah.
As a young girl.
Yeah, she's... So that was that was a raw food community that he started. And then there's a place in California called Joyful News, was another raw food commune. And then I guess the next, even the Seventh-day Adventists were somewhat raw. I mean, Ellen White had these visions, and Dr. John Harvey Kellogg.
He's probably turning over in his grave.
He was very sympathetic to raw food eating, and he he encouraged his patients at the Battle Creek Sanitarium to eat mostly raw, and he himself was something of a raw foodist.
Mm-hmm. So how did
there's this intertwining of religion and raw foodism, which is quite remarkable.
Right. Because people connected to Adam and Eve,
yeah,
and
exactly.
They want to eat like they're in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, in the West, it's the Edenic diet, I think. It's Graham, I think, was the first who, in North America, to try to call people back to the Edenic diet. And Ever since he raised it as a clarion call, I mean, these raw food groups have been wanting to revive the Edenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true even today. You have the American Essenes, you know, like Gabriel Cousins. David Wolfe considers himself to be an Essene minister. Viktoras Kolvinskas, and is also an Essene figure. Sherry Saria is another Essene. They're trying to revive this pre sacrificial Christianity. It's remarkable how the religious component
so
to our dietary preferences.
It actually, you're right, it is. Because in the different religions, I mean, maybe it's not written in law, but there are so many traditional foods that come with holidays.
Yeah, sure.
And that's that makes it really difficult for a lot of people when they want to adopt a plant-based diet, mm-hmm. deal with mm-hmm. the cultural issues.
Yes.
Their families think they're rejecting the tradition.
Exactly.
You know, what's wrong? Did I do something wrong in raising you that you don't want to participate in this?
Especially the Abrahamic, like Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you know, it's considered almost a violation of a religious taboo to be eating, not to be eating flesh or cooked mm-hmm. flesh.
Mm.
And then we have the Hallelujah Acres ministry, probably from
How are they doing?
Well, they seem to be thriving, actually.
Now, they're promoting a vegan diet.
Yeah, I think it's
80%
raw.
Right. Excellent.
20% cooked. The minister who runs it claims to have cured himself, you know, of his cancer
mm-hmm.
by adopting a raw food diet. Well, the Edenic diet, he calls it. The diet that
Adam and Eve.
So again, we're back to Graham and the Edenic diet. Graham was a minister, a Presbyterian minister. So that's the thrust in, I guess, to return to the original diet. And you know, there's something to be said for that.
Okay. So in this book, The Raw, Becoming Raw, there's... It's really fascinating what's in here because it really goes into detail about how you can get all the nutrients you need from raw food. And there are tables in here that compare all the different vitamins that you get from a variety of different raw foods. There's a discussion on enzymes because there's a lot of language that raw foodists use, and some of it isn't very scientific. And so it makes some of the science-minded people roll their eyes, like, what are they talking about? Because raw foodists will talk about their food being alive, or the enzymes being live or dead. And those aren't really the official chemical terms to discuss them. And so there's a nice chapter in here about the great enzyme controversy.
Mm-hmm. And also the there's a discussion of the Kutchikov's discovery that the white blood cell count, you know, rises when you eat, after one has eaten cooked food.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've heard
yes,
that.
Yes, I have heard that. Mm-hmm.
And Brenda Davis said that, you know, it seems a very cogent argument. It sounds very persuasive, but it hasn't really been
proven,
yeah. Because, well, there's no funding. Who's going to put up the money to do a fear-based study on?
Yeah, especially when there's no money to be made.
So she said it sounds very convincing, but it's not, you know, it needs to be tested. Yeah.
So here's something I'm thinking of that I haven't really thought before, but we hear a lot of information in the media, in magazines, on television, on radio, et cetera, about pharmaceutical drugs that can solve a lot of problems and about different products that we can buy. And those are the things that get promoted because there's a profit motive. And yet, despite all of that, the vegan message is slowly getting out there.
Yeah.
And there really isn't a profit motive. There are some entrepreneurial people that are out there that are creating vegan products, and great for them. But basically, the message is getting out because it's a true message.
Yes.
A vegan diet is healthier than a meat-based diet, and animal foods, animal agriculture is devastating to the environment, where growing plant foods is not. And that message is slowly getting out there. And so when people are listening and not knowing what to believe, because there's so much information out there, I would always consider is there a profit motive behind this message?
No.
I'm here as a volunteer, and all I want to do is educate people about healthy plant foods and help people have less pain and suffering and live long, happy, healthy lives.
Yeah. Well, the profit may not be monetary, but, you know, there's certainly a health...
A spiritual profit, or a healthy profit, or an environmental profit.
Yeah.
You contributed a recipe in this book?
Yeah, I think two recipes.
What were they?
One of them, it was the three melon salad, which consists of a portion of honeydew, chopped honeydew, and chunks of cantaloupe and chunks of watermelon.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. Beautiful colors. Yeah. Fresh.
Lovely to look. That's another great thing about raw food. Isn't
it? It's beautiful.
Colorful.
Yeah, yeah, as compared to most meat and dairy products,
slab
which
of
are
dead flesh.
Beige and dull.
Gray and
okay,
cadaverous.
That's the end of the show music.
Great.
So, Rin, thanks for joining me today. Please check out the books, The Vegan Guide to New York City, if you're a New Yorker or you're going to be in New York anytime soon. And a great book to have on nutrition is Becoming Raw, The Essential Guide to Raw Vegan Diets. Thank you for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food.